Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my daily politics podcast from WNYC Studios. In Wednesday night's debate, the word union was mentioned 23 times, according to the word count software I used this morning. Of those 23 times, most were in the context of questioning Bernie Sanders if some of his core policies, even as a Democratic Socialist, are turning union members off. For example, in Nevada, the powerful Culinary Workers Union, with so many members who work in the Las Vegas casinos and places like that, the Culinary Workers Union is not endorsing anyone. And the narrative we're hearing for why is partly because they have good private health insurance and don't want to risk Medicare for All being better or worse. Here's how Sanders addressed the concern.
So let me be very clear to my good friends in the Culinary Workers Union, a great union. I will never sign a bill that will reduce the health care benefits they have. We will only expand it for them, for every union in America, and for the working class of this country.
Senator Warren, you were all in on Medicare for All, and then you have since came up with a transition plan. Is it because of the impact on unions?
So I want to be clear. I've been to the culinary union's healthcare facilities. They're terrific. You don't want to shut them down. You want to expand them. You want to see them all across Nevada and all across this country.
Sanders, Warren, and NBC's Chuck Todd, that 38-second clip contained four of the 23 mentions of the word union right there. We'll play more clips as we go. With me now is a labor organizer and scholar who's got a lot to say about unions and the 2020 race. Jane McAlevey is a senior fellow at the UC Berkeley Labor Center and author of a new book called A Collective Bargain, Unions, Organizing, and the Fight for Democracy. She's also a contributor to The Nation and is quoted in the New York Times Magazine article called Why Are Workers Struggling? Because Labor Law is Broken. Jane, great to have you on again. Thanks for joining us.
It's always good to be with you, Brian, on this show, which I love so much.
Thank you so much. For full disclosure, reading some of your recent things, are you a Bernie Sanders supporter per se?
You know, I am strongly behind either of the non-corporate Democratic candidates. That's been my position, which means Warren and Sanders. I think, you know, I haven't had to make a decision about that, but I would say what I say in the end of a collective bargain is that if the Democratic Party nominates a corporate Democrat, we're going to lose to Donald Trump. And I believe that very strongly. So to me, that leaves two choices right now. And we could get into longer who I think has a better chance to win, but I've not officially made a decision about that. But if I look at, for example, who won Wisconsin, going back to your discussion with Domenico Montanaro, the fact is that in 2016, Sanders, you know, stomped Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primary. So maybe we wouldn't have lost Wisconsin in 2016 had he actually been the candidate back then. And if you look at the electability question of money, ground troops, base, enthusiasm, it feels to me like Sanders has the electability edge in a pretty substantial way. What American workers want to hear, what they want to see, is that there's someone who is not going to just give rhetoric, and frankly, rhetoric is what most American workers have gotten from the National Democratic Party since the early 1970s. We saw Carter said if he got, when Carter ran, he said, you know, if I win and I get 60 plus 60 in the Senate, meaning filibuster proof, I'm going to fix labor law reform. Then Clinton made the same promise, and he also got a plus 60 in the U.S. Senate and did nothing for labor law reform like Carter. Then Obama promised American workers and unions that if he won and got plus 60 in the Senate, which he had, he would fix broken labor law reform, and none of them have. So people are super cynical about the National Democratic Party right now. And one reason why, and as Domenico talked about, the dynamic is not just in the United States, Brian. It's all over the world. I just came back from working with two of the biggest unions in Germany last week, and the same cynicism of the failure of the sort of parties that promised to be the parties for working people is happening all over the world because, in fact, the sort of corporate Democrat model in this country, the corporations, the Wall Street financiers, have been having far too much say over the politics and policies of the Democratic Party. And that's part of why, when I look at the numbers, when I look really carefully. I agree with Domenico. If anyone says they know what's going to happen, you know, they're lying. But when I look at the numbers, and I am working with workers all over the United States, I think Sanders has the electability edge in a very serious way.
On how labor law is broken, in your opinion, I mean, that was part of the title of the Emily Bazelon New York Times Magazine article that you were quoted in. Workers are struggling because labor law is broken. What's broken? Be specific.
Yeah. What I outline in A Collective Bargain in my new book is that there were three waves of attacks on American workers. So we passed what's called the National Labor Relations Act in 1935. I open the book by describing the extraordinary gains American workers made from 1935 to 1947, when the first of three massive attacks that the Democrats have failed to fix begins, which is what's called the Taft-Hartley Act. So in 1947, the first congressional act that repeals most of what American workers won under Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1935. They repeal the real right to strike, they repeal solidarity strikes, they repeal the right of ordinary workers to walk off the job in any meaningful way in this country. That first wave goes from 1947 till the early 1970s. Wave two of attacking American workers and making it why, frankly, we lost to Trump in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, let alone some other key states in 2016. Wave two begins with what they call globalization and trade, which I outline very clearly in the history chapter in my book, was nothing more than breaking the back of American unions and breaking the back of middle class and workers in this country. There was no reason for globalization. We didn't get a more democratic world. What we got was a loss of fast, huge numbers of American jobs. And then wave three was in the 1970s. Similarly, we began to pass a series of laws, increased the power of what's called the union busting operations, the whole consultant class that grew up in the 1980s called the union avoidance industry, which I describe in detail, which essentially meant that as service workers, as the American economy was changing, shifting to a more service-led economy, it's been almost impossible for workers to form unions. So there were three rounds that have gotten us into the mess we're in right now with this evil genius in the White House who's frankly destroying our democracy, which is why in the book I really focus on, we are not going to claim American democracy until we reset the inequality crisis. And the only way to reset the income inequality crisis in this country is for the Democratic Party to get damn serious for the first time in my lifetime about actually restoring the right to strike and the right for workers to form strong unions. And there is one candidate who frankly has been hammering on that his entire adult life. I like Sanders. I like Warren. I kind of want them both, frankly. Mm-hmm. But one of them I think is more electable.
I see that you're very tough in your book on what you call liberal Democrats, meaning merely liberal. You say smashing teachers unions, for example. Why do you put liberal and smashing teachers unions in the same sentence?
Because, frankly, that's what the policy of the National Democratic Party, including under Barack Obama, has been about, actually privatizing schools. Oh, geez, talk about the former mayor of New York, Bloomberg, right? I mean, he led this. It's like smashing teachers' unions by privatizing the American public education system. What I actually go on to say, I think, is that it's basically, like, if you look at the politics of the National Democratic Party, they've been decimating their own electoral base, and they've been decimating it my entire lifetime. As a union organizer, I can tell you how hard it is for workers to form unions. And what I say is that it's something like the equivalent of Mitch McConnell and the Koch brothers, like, waking up and deciding that they're going to destroy the National Rifle Association and they're going to destroy the Evangelical Church in key swing states in 2018. Like, that's the equivalent of what the National Democratic Party has been doing to trade unions for my entire lifetime. And if people don't understand that income inequality in this country, which everyone acknowledges is a crisis, is directly linked to political power inequality. That's the part we have to fix. And the reason I'm so encouraged right now, and the reason I wrote the brand new book, third in the series, is because when what we see right now with workers walking off the job, we've had more workers on strike in the last year than we have in 30 years. And I think we are in this country, we're very close to an early 1930s period. Income inequality was grotesque in the early 1930s, coming off the Great Depression. It's grotesque right now. And what it took in the early 1930s and 32 to rebuild, you know, a middle class in this country and take control away from the plutocrats and the oligarchs was workers walking off the job in massive numbers. So in 32, we elect FDR. What's very important is that in 1933 and 1934 in particular, and 1935, leading up to the passage of the National Labor Relations Act, There were more workers on strike in this country, on illegal strikes. They began in mass numbers to walk off the job to create a crisis that then forced and enabled the passage of the boldest labor law in this country. Flawed as it was in some ways, but it was the boldest act tilting the scales in favor of American workers in the history of America, and that was the National Labor Relations Act. It didn't happen because FDR or Francis Perkins walked in and said, hey, we've got this cool idea. Let's enable workers to have some fairness in the American workplace and have a leg up in the economy. It happened because workers took huge risks and walked off the job all over the country, creating many general strikes in Seattle, in Minneapolis. I mean, I could go through a whole long list of it, but I detail it in one short chapter in the new book called Who Killed the Unions?
I'm sorry, I stepped on your line there. What's the name of the chapter?
That chapter is called Who Killed the Unions?
But
to make it clear, it wasn't an accident. They were killed.
If you see this as an analogous time to the beginning of that period, why aren't workers walking out? Why aren't workers in the streets today?
Well, they are. I mean, that's a fact. That's what's happened. We've had more workers on strike in the last year than we have in 30 years. That is, for people like me, an enormous growth, right? We've seen teachers walking out all across the country. We saw the AT&T workers walking out in 9 southern states. We saw the Stop and Shop workers walking off the job. And by the way, what's super important is that every time we've seen workers walking off the job, the American public has been, like, resoundingly supporting them. And I think that there was this 30-year lull after Ronald Reagan smashed the air traffic control workers in 1981 and showed that as president of the United States, he was willing to destroy the lives of 12,000 workers who went on strike. There was this fear that set in. I think it was an error. I think it was a big mistake on the part of trade unions. I'm in the camp that says, you know, we need to be able to enable workers to take high-risk action to level the power in this country that's so deeply skewed in favor of the super rich and the corporate class. So I think there was this 30-year lull where people were nervous, people were scared, and people are fed up, and they are beginning to walk out. I mean, the West Virginia strike in 2018 by 34,000 workers shut down the entire public education system, and the entire strike was illegal. That is what we began to see in 1933, when political and income inequality were so skewed in favor of the super rich as they are today. So I think we are seeing the beginning of a very serious fight back.
Bob in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Jane McAlevey. Hi.
Oh, thank you. Hello there, Professor McAlevey. I once spoke to the head of the Steelworkers Union, Leo Girard, on a radio program, and I told him I lost sympathy for your membership because I know they're going to vote Republican. So it seems to me it's the white working class that empowers the rich and the corporations. They're the ones voting for Donald Trump. And may I relate a brief story, too? I belong to the local Democratic Club. It's not a liberal club. It's a regular club. And I live in a community. I'm not going to say which neighborhood. But these people here, white working class people, absolutely idolize Donald Trump. They always vote Republican. They're union members, some of them. Some of them are state employees or government employees. And some of them are retired. They're on Medicare or they have parents on Medicare. And I asked them, why are you voting against your own economic interests? And what I get from back then, I kind of infer this, they have such xenophobia, especially against non-white immigrants. They seem to think the Republicans, especially Trump, are protecting their jobs, even if it's government jobs, union jobs, and all of their entitlement programs, they're protecting them as white people. And I think the Democrats want to take away all their benefits to give it to minorities and immigrants. How do you fight something like this?
Jane.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate the question, but quite honestly, I've been working with workers in just nearly 50 states in this country, and there's a minority of them who I think agree with that position. So first of all, when we talk about the working class, one thing that is really making me crazy in this election cycle is that the working class in this country is not white. It's a multiracial working class. It's very diverse. In fact, in the new book, I talk about the fact that we're at a point now where the new trade union movement is mostly women and mostly women of color. That's the future in this country, given where the job growth is, which is healthcare for sure, education, someone in logistics. But the growth fields in the current economy trend very differently than they did 50 or 100 years ago. So whether or not you can, I mean, I've met plenty of workers who support Republicans, but that's, when I say plenty, that's nowhere near the vast majority of them. So one thing is we have to be clear about who we're talking about. And part of what's so exciting is when you look at the strikes by the West Virginia teachers, if you look at the strikes by the Los Angeles teachers, by the Chicago teachers, by the educators walking off the job all over this country, it's a very different face of the labor movement, and it's articulating very strong goals that start with how do we build the best public education system in this country that we can? How do we reverse 40 years of attacks on government and on public schools and public education? And how do we make it so that kids and our whole communities can live a better, more fair life? That's frankly the majority of the movement right now in the trade union movement, and I think people need to wake up and look at how bold a vision is coming from the new leadership in today's trade union movement, because it is a robust, beautiful movement. And when I had to suffer through listening to Bloomberg on that stage the other night, I thought to myself, he was one of the strongest advocates in this country of destroying public, high-quality public education for all. And you've got a new movement that's a trade union movement led by bold women of color in this country who are demanding that we fix our entire community for the whole of society. That's the dominant message today, and that's the one I'm talking about in the book. And in the book, I highlight tons of examples of workers winning bold campaigns since Trump won. The whole focus of my new book looks at the workers and the trade unions that are winning, and they're winning on a bold message, and they're winning on a message that our job is to erase the line between the workplace and society and fight for the whole of the working class.
We're almost out of time, so I'm going to have to make some choices out of the many things we could be talking about. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to play one more clip from the debate. And this time it's Chuck Todd challenging Sanders about working people's support on another issue besides Medicare for All.
You want a total ban on natural gas extraction, fracking in the next 5 years. The industry obviously supports a lot of jobs around the country, including thousands in the battleground state of Pennsylvania. One unit official there told the New York Times, quote, "If we end up with a Democratic candidate that supports a fracking ban, I'm going to tell my members that either you don't vote or you vote for the other guy." What do you tell these workers? It's supporting a big industry right now, sir.
What I tell these workers is that the scientists are telling us that if we don't act incredibly boldly within the next 6-7 years, there will be irreparable damage done, not just to Nevada, not just to Vermont or Massachusetts, but to the entire world. Joe said it right. This is an existential threat. You know what that means, Chuck? That means we're fighting for the future of this planet. And the Green New Deal that I support, by the way, will create up to 20 million good-paying jobs as we move our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy.
So, Jane, we have a minute left in the segment, but is this, again, Sanders running on advantages for non-rich working people of something that he's going to have to talk them into if they have good jobs now that don't require college that they need to sacrifice for a greater good?
No, not at all. In fact, part of what's so brilliant about the Green New Deal is that the most important concept is that no worker who currently has a decent standard of living, let's call it a union contract with good standards, not one of those workers under the Green New Deal proposal would lose their standards. Part of what people don't understand about the Green New Deal, and I can appreciate why, but the most important thing I say, and I have a whole chapter about this as well in the new book, part of what, and I spent half my life as an environmental campaigner before I became a trade union organizer and went back to my family roots, so these issues are deeply intertwined to me. I care about all of them passionately. But the most important thing that every candidate has to guarantee the American worker who's in the fossil fuel polluting industries is that they will not sacrifice either a good union contract or the standards that they currently hold that they fought for as we transition into a new economy. And that's the beauty behind the Green New Deal, and that's why we need candidates who understand it's going to take a serious movement on the ground, not just to win that policy, but to win the governing power to actually change policy in America in favor of saving the planet and saving life on it and creating good jobs for American workers.
Jane McAlevey is a senior fellow at the UC Berkeley Labor Center and author of the brand new book, A Collective Bargain, Unions, Organizing, and the Fight for Democracy. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
And listeners, we want to invite you in on the conversation, too. If you've got a question about a national news item, whether it's something you want to know about the election or the Trump administration or anything else you think might fall under the national politics umbrella, give us a call and leave us a message with your name, where you're calling from, and your question. We'll collect those and keep them in our pocket for when I'm speaking with someone who can give you a good answer. The number is 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255, 844-745-TALK. Have a great weekend. Talk to you Monday.